So we are in a series on the church, and I want to welcome you back for round two. If you felt like, you know, it was just kind of like a boxing match last week, and we're in round two, and we're just going to keep battling out this whole idea of the church. And last week we saw, we had a news flash, and for some of you it's like, this isn't anything new. So I don't know why we call it a news flash, but the news flash was this: the church is not perfect. And for many of you, you're like, yeah, we've known this for like 2,000 years. I mean, the moment the church started, we knew the church wasn't perfect. And we looked back a little bit last week at maybe why the church is not perfect. And one of the areas we looked at was some of the hypocrisy in the church that, you know, there's just like Christians do not live the Christian life very well. And so one of the challenges, I think, as Christians, and we kind of set ourselves up for hypocrisy, is every time we make the Christian life about ourselves, we're going to be found to be hypocrites. And we got to do a better job of pointing everything we do, our lives, how we act, but even how we talk, to Jesus the person. And we looked at that a little bit last week, and we saw even from the Apostle Peter that he kind of fell into hypocrisy when he started to care what people thought, and he started to make the faith a little bit more about him and what he did and the Jewish believers and circumcision rather than Jesus. And we come to God through faith in Jesus and through faith alone. But this hypocrisy is just a real deal in the church today. And last week I read a statement, you know, there's 10 areas that Christians, you know, statistically aren't really any different than non-Christians or non-believers in Jesus. And you know, everything from viewing pornographic websites to lying to taking things that weren't yours. And so it's just kind of like, why, you know, Christians are supposed to be morally better, and yet so often we're not. And that's just a real challenge for us as a church, but also for those on the outside kind of saying, why would I want to be part of a church if they're no different than me? What's the point? And then they're just a bunch of hypocrites. And last week I talked a little bit about the fact that Jesus actually anticipated hypocrisy in the church, and so much so that he anticipated a hypocrisy in the church that that would even lead to self-deception. And he said, some people, they're going to say, Lord, Lord, but they're not really my followers, my disciples. And so there's for reals and there's fakers, right? And he anticipated that. In fact, he anticipated the hypocrisy would go so far that some would be self-deceived. They actually didn't realize that they were being hypocritical and that they would be on the outside. So we know that not everyone who's in the church is a Christian. And so the reason the church is messed up is partly because not all of us are maybe even following or walking with Jesus, but we would consider ourselves in the church. The other thing is there's many people that are Christians and they're just messed up too. And probably if you're here this morning, you're like, I'm a Christian, you would look into the interior of your own life and you say, it's messed up. And so even those that are in the church or part of the church and that are believers are still messed up. So how do we make sense of this? And is it going to change? And last week I told you it's probably not going to change anytime soon. And that's because every week we're going to have a news flash, just so you know. This week's news flash is going to let you know why it's not going to change anytime soon, why the church isn't going to become perfect anytime soon. And here's why. And I promise the news flashes get a little more news breaking each message. Okay. So last week is like, okay, of course the church is not perfect. But this week, news flash, the church is not for the perfect. The church isn't perfect, and it's not going to change anytime soon because the church is not for the perfect. You know, maybe sometimes you've heard this, or maybe you've even said this yourself. You know, people will say, you know, the church just isn't for me. And I want to tell you right now, the church is for you. In fact, the church is for anyone. One of our statements in our value statements is that the church is for all people. Mount Olive Church, we want to be a church that is for all people, because we believe when Jesus instituted the church, he made it for all people, except for one kind of person. There's one kind of person that the church is not for. And that is the perfect. If you are perfect, or you think you are perfect, the church is not for you. In fact, if you think that you're perfect, stay away, so far away from church, as far away from church as heaven is from hell. Because the church is not for you if you are perfect. And in fact, if you're looking for a perfect church and you find it, don't ever attend it, because you'll wreck it. And sorry, I'm bursting your bubble here, but if you ever find a perfect church, don't attend it, because the moment you attend it, you will wreck it. And if you're looking for a church with a perfect pastor, don't come to Mount Olive, because you ain't finding one here, okay? The other thing is, if you're looking for a perfect pastor, even if the Apostle Paul or the Apostle Peter came back and pastored that church, you'd still be looking for another church because they weren't perfect either. There is no perfect church, and the church is not for the perfect. You know, the problem with thinking the church should be perfect, I think, is the problem with thinking the church is perfect is that we've misunderstood Christianity. And Christianity is not about our good works. It's not about what we can do. In fact, it's the opposite. It's all about Christianity. The Christian life is all about what Christ has done for us. Jesus lived a perfect life because we couldn't and because we still can't. And we accept him and we accept his perfection by faith. And so Christianity is not about what we can do. Rather, Christianity is about what God has done for us in the person of Jesus. So the church is not perfect. In fact, the church will never be perfect until Christ comes back, because the church is not for the perfect. The only disqualifier for you coming into the kingdom of God, the only disqualifier for you being part of the church, is thinking that you are perfect, because then you're already too good and you don't need God anyways. You know, Jesus once told a parable about this very thing. And in this parable, a parable is a story that Jesus made up. It's not a true story, but it's so true to so many of us because it's real life. But he told this story, and in this parable, Jesus kind of shows us who God accepts and what God wants of us. And I think this parable is a picture of what Jesus, what God wants the church to look like, and who's accepted in the church, and how we should act as the church, and all of that. So if you have your Bibles, go to Luke chapter 18. In fact, I'll put it up on the screen, and I want us to read this parable together, and then I'm going to make some comments on it, okay? So let's read this out loud all together, and if you're in the chapel, you have to read it real loud because we can't hear you through the wall too well. Okay, so here we go, all together. To some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, God, I thank you that I am not like other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get. But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Thank you. You know, before we even get into the story, the parable that Jesus tells, Luke actually gives us a little bit of a precursor, a little bit of an indication as to why Jesus told this parable. And he says this, to some who were confident of their own righteousness, and then that led them to looking down on everyone else, Jesus tells this parable. So this parable is aimed at a certain group of people. It's aimed at the proud, those who are self-confident. And here's the deal. Confidence isn't bad, but when it comes to righteousness, it seems to be a bad thing when you are self-confident in your own righteousness. And being self-confident in your own righteousness, what we see in this story, actually, it leads to something that's really, really bad. And that is, this person looked down on everybody else. And so he tells this story, and it's aimed at those who are arrogant, spiritually arrogant and prideful, those who are self-righteous. And he says, two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. Two men that, as far as you can tell in that culture at that time, they were at complete opposite ends of the spiritual spectrum. You know, Pharisees were usually devoutly Jewish, and they were, you know, keeping the law. They were loyal to the nation of Israel. Tax collectors, on the other hand, they were not devoted to the nation at all, and they were not devoted to the law of God really at all either. A tax collector, I've told you this many times, represented kind of the worst of the worst. They were just, often we read in the Gospels, you know, the writers of the Gospels say there were sinners and tax collectors, and I've told you this. You know, tax collectors, because they're always kind of stated on their own, because they were in a sinning category of their own. So, you know, you had sinners And then you had tax collectors, and sinners were kind of here, and the tax collectors were on the bottom rung of spirituality. They were the furthest from God. And you know, if your son was a tax collector, you know, people may say, you know, to a tax collector, say, your mom doesn't even love you, because that was like the worst thing, right? If you're a mom, you're like, just be a thief or, you know, be a murderer, but don't be a tax collector. That's just the worst of the worst. I'll disown you if you're a tax collector. And here's why. Because tax collectors, they were Jewish people that worked for the Roman Empire that was ruling over the Jewish people. And so they were Jewish people collecting taxes for the hated Romans, but then often what they did is they collected more than they were supposed to, and they became rich from their very own oppressed people. Often their own relatives and their own used-to-be friends, they would take this money. And so you can see how, you know, everyone just hated the tax collectors. They're just traitors, and they're the worst of the worst. Your mom wouldn't even love you if you were a tax collector, okay? I made that up, but it's true. Okay, and likewise, the Pharisee was kind of, in the public eye, he was the picture of perfection. I mean, if there was a morally perfect person, if there was someone who was close to God, it was obviously a Pharisee. And so we have the lowest of the low spiritually, probably the one everyone in society would say they are the furthest from God. And then you have the highest of the high spiritually. Everyone would say, if anyone's accepted before God, it has to be this guy, the Pharisee. And they both go to the temple. Now the temple, up to that time, it was the very place where God's presence dwelt. The Holy of Holies was at the temple. And so they both go to the temple, to the place where God dwells, and they do what you do if you want to talk to God. They prayed. And we're told the Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, God, I thank you that I am not like other people. You know, robbers and evildoers and adulterers, or this guy, this tax collector, even like this tax collector. And then he says, here's how and here's why I'm so different. I fast twice a week and I give a tenth of all I get. Now, I don't know if you notice this in the prayer, but notice how many times he says I. And notice how many times he says God or you. And it's interesting. I don't think this man's praying to God, other than just a slight cursory, you know, a mention of God at the beginning. The entire prayer is not directed at God. It's directed at himself. And so he stands off by himself and also prays to himself. And he says, I'm sure glad I'm not. And he has this little conversation with himself as to his own righteousness. He's self-confident in what he has done. And everything he's done, he's done. He doesn't lie. He is extremely, extremely moral. He is true. It's true. He's not like robbers. He's not like adulterers. He's not like evildoers. And he's nothing like this tax collector. Morally, he is far superior. And he lists some of the things he does. You know, he says, I fast twice a week. Now, in the law, this was going way beyond what the law required of anyone. In the law, there was only one compulsory, obligatory fast in the calendar. One day a year where Jews were asked to fast. And that was the Day of Atonement. But by the time of Jesus, some of the religious leaders, because they're so passionate, they were so intent on following God, and they wanted to follow God, and they wanted to have a relationship and know God and do things so rightly, that they had started fasting on Mondays and Thursdays, twice a week. Now, what's interesting, William Barclay in his commentary says, it happens in history, we find out that Mondays and Thursdays actually happen to be market day in Jerusalem. And so all the people from the countryside would come to the city. And so this was the day that the city was absolutely overrun with people. And the 2 days that they decided to make fast days were Mondays and Thursdays. And Jesus once tells us, and I think it's the Gospel of Matthew, he says, you know, people, they kind of, they discolor their faces and they show everyone they're fasting. He's talking about Pharisees. And they pick the day when most people are in the city to show them how very righteous they were and how much God must be pleased with them because they were so, so, so righteous. And so he goes above and beyond the law in the sense of fasting. No one was required to fast as much. But he also goes above and beyond the law in his tithe. See, in the Old Testament, the tithe was prescribed to give a tenth of what the land produces of your produce. But he says, I give a tenth, not of just what the land produces, of everything I get, even things that aren't from the land. And so this man, he was going above and beyond in morality. He was going above and beyond in his fasting and in his tithing. And if you take out humility before God, and if you take out love and compassion for others, the Pharisee is exceptionally, exceptionally spiritual. Now, unfortunately for the Pharisee, the two things that matter most to God are humility before God and our love and compassion to others. And he missed it. I love what Leon Morris says about this Pharisee when he writes this. He says, what the Pharisee said about himself was true. He wasn't lying. He was telling the truth. His trouble was not that he was far enough along the road, but that he was on the wrong road altogether. The problem wasn't that he was so far along the road. He was a long way along the road of moralism. He was a long way along the road of spirituality in the sense of keeping the law and going above and beyond the law and fasting and tithing. The problem wasn't that he was a long way along the road. The problem was he missed the road altogether. And what God desires most is humility and love and compassion for others. Now, in contrast, the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven. You know, often when they prayed, they would stand in their time. They'd go to the temple and they would stand to pray. Now, we often sit or kneel to pray, but they stood to pray. And they would often look up to heaven. They're talking to God. But this tax collector would not even look up to heaven, but rather he beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. He beat his breast as a sign of humility and brokenness before God and said, have mercy on me. Now, the word mercy in Greek is the same word we would translate often the word propitiation or atonement. Now, maybe those are big words, but atonement carries this idea of propitiation and expiation, which are really big theological words that I'll explain, but they both tie back to the word atonement. Now, atonement, propitiation has to do with appeasement of wrath, and so there's this wrath, there's this something coming against you, and you pay for it, so you don't get the wrath. So that's propitiation, it's a payment for wrath. Expiation is a cleansing or a covering over of sin. Now, both these ideas of appeasement of wrath and the removal of sin are tied together in the idea of atonement. Now, long before Jesus, God had actually instituted with the people of God, the Israelites, he had instituted the sacrificial system. Now, to us, the sacrificial system is kind of weird and barbaric, but to them, it had very, very strong meaning. And the reason was this. It was all tied to sin and sin at the very beginning. See, at the beginning, God had told the first man and woman, he had said, listen, if you disobey me, if you sin, you will surely die. And so the penalty of sin has always been death. Now, we get this, even if we don't get the sacrificial system or death and sin and all that, we get this on a relational level. If you're in a relationship with someone and they sin severely, they do something so wrong against you, you know what happens to that relationship instantly. It is broken. In a sense, it dies because sin always brings death. And so God had told them, he said, listen, if you sin, death will enter the world physically, but also relationally. Your relationship to God, it will be severed, it will be broken, it will die, but your relationship to others will also be broken and die. Sin always brings death. Sin always demands a payment, and the payment for sin is always death. And so God, in his great mercy, actually, in the Old Testament said, listen, instead of you guys dying, instead of your relationship being severed between you and me, I'm going to allow you to do something that we think is weird, but is very, very gracious. God said, I'll let you kill an animal, often a goat or a bull. I'll let you kill an animal as payment for your sin so you don't die. I'll let you kill an animal so that the broken relationship between you and I may be covered over, it may be removed. And so this was the Day of Atonement. On the Day of Atonement, the high priest would take two goats, and he would go into the Holy of Holies and make a sacrifice for the sin of the entire nation. But then he'd take two goats, and this is very interesting. It has to do with propitiation, appeasement of the wrath, and expiation, which means the removal of sin. He would take two goats, and he'd cast a dice. Or cast lots. And the one that lost the lot, that goat would be killed for the people's sin. And so that would be propitiation. It would appease the wrath because someone has to die, right? And then the other goat that kind of won the toss, the sins of the people would be confessed over that goat, and then it would be sent into the desert as a physical sign that the people's sin has actually been lifted up, carried off, it's no longer here. Beautiful picture. Atonement. And when this tax collector comes and says, have mercy on me, what he's saying is, do what the Day of Atonement did for the people of Israel. Propitiation, cover over my sin. I know what I deserve, God. I know what my sin has earned me. It has earned me death, and it's earned me your wrath. But I know what it's earned me, but would you take it away? He knew what he deserved. You know, it's interesting. The tax collector didn't deflect or excuse his sin. He didn't try to blame others. You know, he didn't say, hey, God, you know I was born into a tough family situation, and you know that I was born impoverished, and my family had no money, and tax collecting was the only way I could make a living, and I was just kind of, I just didn't have a chance in life. He didn't deflect his sin. He owned it, and he never said, God, you knew my father. You know how he was abusive in my life. You know how he left us, and he was absent. He was a terrible dad, and he didn't blame his sin on others. He didn't deflect or blame. He owned his sin. He knew what his sin had earned him. And so he said, God, would you have mercy? Would you, would you remove my sin? And would you pay for my sin? God, have mercy on me, a sinner. You know, the word a sinner is actually literally the sinner. Literally, the sinner. Like the Pharisee, the tax collector put himself into a class all his own. There was nobody like him. He was the sinner. Just like the Pharisee put himself in a class of righteousness all of his own, I'm sure glad I'm not like. I'm in a class of my own in righteousness. The tax collector put himself in a class all his own and said, there is no one like me. I am the sinner. If there was a picture of a sinner in the world, take a picture of me. I am the sinner. You know, this is very reminiscent of something the Apostle Paul would actually write some probably 40 or 50 years later to a young up-and-coming pastor, Timothy. Paul would write this. He said, here's a trustworthy saying, Timothy, that deserves full acceptance. Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, of whom I am the worst. I am the worst. You know, my personal understanding of what Paul writes here is that Paul is writing a statement that is what it says. This is a trustworthy saying that deserves full acceptance, not just by me, Paul, but by everyone who claims to be a Christ follower. Jesus came into the world to save sinners, of whom I am the worst. Paul believed that he was the sinner, not a sinner. The sinner, just like the tax collector said, I am the sinner. But here's the question, how could you quantify sin? You know, how could Paul say, I am the worst of sinners? I mean, how do you even, I don't think Paul was standing up and saying, hey, let's start an argument and let's compare notes as to who's the worst sinner in the room. I think what he's saying is this is the posture that every Christian, every Christ follower should take. The posture of the tax collector, the posture of the apostle Paul, who said, I am the worst of sinners. If there was a picture of a sinner, I am it. Because I understand I can't do one thing to get myself closer to God. See, there's a lot of people in history that have done a lot worse things morally than Paul ever did. And yet Paul said, I am the worst of sinners, because he understood something about God. It's our salvation, our being saved, even our righteousness is nothing we've done. It's all in Jesus. To the church in Ephesus, he writes this, for it is by grace you have been saved through faith. This is not from yourselves. It's not from you. It's not what you can conjure up. It's not how good you can live your life. There is no righteousness that you can do that will save you, that will make you right with God. It is by grace you have been saved through faith. This isn't from yourself. It's a gift of God, not by works, so that no one can boast. All of salvation is a gift of God. It's all God's grace. You know, I grew up in a pretty good home, and I've told you some of my story. And I never really had a really bad rebellious stage. I mean, I had a little bit of rebellious here and there, but I didn't have like a real rebellious stage. And often as growing up, I would hear the testimonies of people, you know, amazing stories of God's grace. You know, people that would tell their story and they'd be like, you know, I spent years in prison and I did drugs and I killed someone and I stole and I slept around and I committed all these great sins. And then somehow God got a hold of my life and I've been saved. And it's just this amazing testimony of God's grace. And growing up, I often had this thought, you know, my story just isn't that amazing. You know, I never really did any of those great sins that we might consider great sins. But the reason I didn't think I had a great testimony is because I didn't understand myself as a great sinner. I'd missed it. I didn't see myself as the tax collector or as Paul, the worst of sinners. You know, I thought that my good life was actually something about what I did. I'd become self-confident in my own righteousness. But since I've come to realize how great a sinner I am, and God is revealing some things about the very interior of who I am, revealing how great a sinner I am on the inside, struggling with self-righteousness and arrogance and pride, what we're going to see later, that's the greatest of all sins. You know, I've come to realize that the things I haven't done in the body, you know, sleeping around or killing or whatever you describe as like, that's the worst thing, is not because I'm good. That too is chalked up because of God's grace. I come to see everything as God's grace. See, some of God's grace, it's kind of like post-grace. You know, we do stupid things, and God's grace is there, and it pulls us back, and it forgives us, and it removes our sin. But I think there's also pre-grace. The things that I haven't done aren't because I'm so awesome. The things I haven't done in the body are because of God's grace also. It's all God's grace. You know, the Pharisee's prayer would have been fine if he would have chalked everything up he hadn't done to God's grace, but he didn't. He chalked it up to his own righteousness, and thus he had no need for God. Listen, church, we are saved by God's grace, and anything we haven't done, if you say, oh, I'm thankful I haven't done some of these things, isn't because of your righteousness. It's also because of God's grace to you. Like Paul said, it's time we see ourselves as we actually are, the worst of sinners. Jesus once said, he who has been forgiven much loves much, but he who's been forgiven little loves little. If you find you don't love God much, you may need to think about how much you've been forgiven. If we don't chalk everything up to God's grace, I think we will become prideful and arrogant, because self-confidence in our own righteousness always leads to arrogance and pride. And you know what God hates? You know there's a list of things God hates in Scripture? There's a list. He writes down a list of all the things he hates. It's found in Proverbs chapter 6, verse 16 to 19. And guess what's at the very top, the very first thing on the things that God hates? It's not what we might expect. It's not lying or murder or sexual immorality. The very first thing on the list is haughty eyes. Not hot eyes like, wow, those are haughty. H-A-U-G-H-T-Y. I think I spelled that right. Haughty eyes. Haughty eyes is that spiritual arrogance. It's what the Pharisee did, and it's what Jesus got so ticked at the Pharisees for so often. It's that disdainful look to others that says, I'm better than you. It's that idea. Haughty eyes is this. It's saying, I'm sure glad I'm not like. That's haughty eyes, and that's what God hates. There's an amazing book called Accidental Pharisees, written by Larry Osborne, who's an e-free church guy in the U.S. And we as a staff have gone through this book twice in the last 3 years. And that's because 4 or 5 years ago when I became lead pastor, I decided that we as a staff would go through this book every 3 years, because this book helps reset any spiritual arrogance or any pride that is, listen, spiritual arrogance and pride is what we're prone to when we live moral lives and when we have an extreme passion to follow Jesus. It's our blind side. And we don't want to become Pharisees. We accidentally become Pharisees. And here's what he writes in his book, accidental Pharisees regarding pride, arrogance, and haughty eyes. He says, I remember once meeting, this is Larry Osborne, I remember once meeting with a group of guys who were passionate about their walk with God. Somehow the conversation turned toward people who were not so passionate about following God. Next thing I knew, they were ripping on the way everyone else raised their kids, spent their money, read their Bible, and set their priorities. It was one of those, aren't you glad we're not like those guys? Sound familiar? When I called them on it, they were mildly remorseful, sort of like they'd gotten busted for a speeding ticket. But it was clear that no one felt particularly convicted or was determined not to go there again. So Larry, he decides, I'm going to give him God's perspective on this and see if it changes some things. So he said, I started with Satan and the fall that was also from pride. And then he says, but the shocker for most of these guys was a list of things God hates. It's found in Proverbs 6, 16 to 19. And right at the top of the list, God says, I hate it when you do this list is haughty eyes. The disgusted and disdainful look of arrogance that parallels the harsh conversation we just had about others. Now, there's lots of things that can anger God. Few people would guess that looking down on others would be at the top of the list, yet it is. As I told the guys that afternoon, if this passage really means what it says, God would rather have us struggling with porn than with pride. Now, that got their attention. But it's true. Their dismissive and judgmental words from earlier in the day weren't minor chit-chat. They were major sin, top of the list sin. God takes seriously our pride and our arrogance. And what he hates most of all is our pride and our spiritual arrogance. You know, the Pharisee's prayer never got off the floor. God never heard his prayer. First of all, because it wasn't prayed to God, it was prayed to himself. And secondly, because it was full of spiritual arrogance and pride. God was uninvolved in that person's life. Look at the summarizing statement that Jesus makes regarding these two men. He says this, I tell you that this man, that's the tax collector, this man went, rather than the other, the Pharisee, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. The tax collector, Jesus says, took the right posture. God, have mercy on me, the sinner. And he humbled himself, and God justified him. Justified means just as if I'd never done it. His slate was wiped clean. It was like he'd never sinned. God justified him. And Jesus summarizes how God views us. And this summary statement that God humbles those who exalt themselves and he exalts those who humble themselves is actually an Old Testament concept in Proverbs as well. In fact, it's found in Proverbs 3:34, and Peter, one of Jesus' closest disciples in 1 Peter chapter 5, would reiterate it, and he'd say this, God opposes, he says it that strongly, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Now, if this is how God treats people, then I think we as a church should treat people this way too. If we truly see ourselves as the worst of sinners, I think then we will be so humble that we'll never be high enough to look down on anyone else. If we truly see ourselves as the worst of sinners, as not perfect, we will never be high enough to look down on someone else. And I think we should mimic God in this, that God opposes the proud and gives grace to the humble. You know, years ago when I was a youth pastor, I'd get our youth leaders to fill out a covenant. You know, I'm gonna commit to live this and I'm gonna do this. And there was some purity things in there and spiritual life things because they're leaders of the youth and I wanted them to, you know, live a stronger Christian life and so on. But at the end, and I've done this with our elders too, I always told our youth leaders, I said, listen, if you struggle to follow some of these commitments, if you're struggling with pornography or something, and that's just, I want you to come and tell me. And here's the deal. God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. If you come to me and you humble yourself and you confess what you're struggling with, you will receive so much grace from me. But if I find out through the grapevine and you're trying to hide this because you're so prideful that you're trying to just hide this thing and you're giving this good look like everything's going on, but you're struggling with this and you're too prideful to humble yourself and confess to me, I will come against you strongly. Because God, this is how God treats us as well. You know, the church is not for the perfect. The church is for the humble and the broken sinner. So if you're perfect, stay as far from church as heaven is from hell, because you will not fit. But if you're broken, and you're a sinner, and you say, God, I need you, then church is for you. In fact, Mount Olive Church is the best place you can be. You know, we've often said this, but no perfect people allowed, and it's true. So what do we do about the imperfections of the church? Because that's still a bit of a challenge. Shouldn't Christians be morally better than those who aren't Christians? Well, here's the answer. The answer is yes, and the answer is no. And let me explain. Notice in the parable, there's no indication that the tax collector ever changed his life. We don't know if he went and changed his life. We don't know. According to the parable, the Pharisee went home, still the more immoral man, but the tax collector went home the more justified man. And we don't ever know if the tax collector changed his life. Now, obviously, if true repentance was to take place, eventually the tax collector would start to change his life. In fact, I think a chapter or two later, we read in Luke the story of Zacchaeus. I don't know how you guys say it, but you're wrong. It's Zacchaeus. When he repented, he changed his life and gave money back to those who he had stolen from. But in this case, we're not told, and I would guess that the tax collector would never, if you just gauge morality, he would never be the more moral man compared to the Pharisee. But here's what's true of the tax collector. He will always be the more justified man. He will always be the more justified man because of his posture before God. Here's what I think we as a church so often make judgments on. We look at people and we judge them based on where they are rather than on where they have come from. And I think as a church, if we're going to really live this out without looking down on others, we need to start asking the question, not where are you now? We need to ask the question, where have you come from? Because I think it changes everything. Let me give you an example. Imagine there's a person who came to our church with tattoos all over their body. Many of the tattoos were curse words, and sometimes they said curse words, and we saw them, you know, from time to time chewing tobacco and having the odd cigarette. You know, we might look at them and conclude, you know, you need to step it up as a Christian, you know. You just need to stop swearing. You need to stop, you know, smoking and whatever it is. And we just, you know, you need to start, changing your life a little more. And we judge them based on where they currently are rather than how far they've come. But imagine if this person grew up in East Hastings, Vancouver, or in the gang scene in Los Angeles, or that's far away. Let me just put this closer. What if he grew up in Troshu? Okay, so just what if... That was for you. Okay, what if he grew up in the north area of Three Hills? That's where I live, okay? That's me. Now, what if we didn't know, but they had done drugs their entire life? They'd lived immorally. They'd spent time in prison for murder and thievery and rape. And now, all they struggle with, they came to Christ a year ago, and all they struggle with is the odd cigarette and foul language. If we knew that and we asked the question, how far have we come? We'd say, wow, what God has all done in your life. And we would judge them differently, wouldn't we? Or likewise, what if we saw someone come to church and they're so polite? You know, they dress in a tie and they treat people kindly and they're just this real moral person. But what we don't know is that long before they came to Christ, they'd always worn a tie, and they'd always treated people kindly. In fact, they came to Christ, and if you look at their life, nothing's changed. And maybe what you don't know is that interiorly, they have haughty eyes, and they look down on everyone for not being as moral as they are. And we'd say, where are you now? Boy, they're doing pretty well. But if we ask, where have you come from? Nothing's changed since they've come to Christ. Who's been transformed more by the gospel? Who's been transformed more by Jesus? And yet we judge one with a critical, I'm better than you judgment, and the other we say, well, you must be good. And I think that's a wrong way of looking at it. I think we need to ask a new question, not where are you? We need to ask the question, how far have you come? What has God done in you? We need to stop thinking as the church that we're better than everyone else. And we need to realize that the church is for the imperfect. It's for those who are not perfect. And you know, the church will always be a place of imperfection, and here's why. It may never change. Because those who are drawn to God are most often those who feel spiritually bankrupt. Those who are moral already often don't feel like they need God. I'm already moral. I'm already living a good life. I already have everything. Why would I need God? And it's often those who feel spiritually bankrupt, like they have this thing in their life that, and it's often sin and brokenness in their lives. And they say, I just need God, because they feel a need for God because they're a tax collector. And so I think if Mount Olive Church is going to be Mount Olive Church, we are constantly going to be having an influx of people who are broken. And if we see ourselves right, I think we'll see ourselves as the broken as well. You know, it's often been said the church is like a hospital, a spiritual hospital. It's for the humble and the broken sinner. And you know, people that go to the hospital are usually sick, not healthy. And here's what none of us do. None of us walk through the halls of the hospital and shout into all the rooms and said, you bunch of idiots, why are you sick? No, that would be foolish. And yet, what do we do when we come to church and we look at people and say, you don't even have your life together? Of course not. We're a hospital for people who are broken, people who still need God to do some transformative work in their lives. And we need to be patient and gracious and humble enough for us to understand that we're broken with them. We're broken with them. You know, Jesus got in trouble mostly because he hung out with sinners. And he got accused for hanging out with sinners. And we have, as a church, will always be a church for sinners. In fact, I think we as a church will always cater to sinners who know they're sinners than to sinners who think they're righteous. We will always cater to sinners who know they're sinners than to sinners who think they're righteous. So I want to ask you, are you humble? Do you see yourself as a sinner? Or do you see yourself as the sinner? In what areas and what sins do you kind of look down on? You know, you are just such a good parent and you just have this tendency to look down on other parents. Now, you've never drank alcohol and you just look down on people who drink alcohol. You've never smoked drugs and you just kind of look down on those who's, you've never had a tattoo. I don't know what it is. What are the areas that you just kind of, you have this haughty eyes and you need to confess that? I want to invite the band up. We're going to close with a song, but before we do, the closing prayer today is going to be a congregational prayer, and it's a prayer of confession. And so the band can come up, and we're going to sing a song, but in this prayer of confession, after we're done praying it, I want you to take some time, and just you and God, and say, God, what are the areas where I am tending to be self-righteous? And God says, that's a top-of-the-list kind of sin, and this is your time to do some confession before God. So let's pray this prayer together, and then you'll have about 60 seconds to do some just personal self-confession as well. God, we confess that we have been confident in our own works rather than yours. We have lived with pride and self-righteousness. We have had haughty eyes looking down on those who think to be less moral than us. We have, even by accident or in our desire to follow you, become proud of our own righteousness and lost compassion for others. God, have mercy on us. Help us be a church, a people who love like you love, a church that is compassionate to the broken and the sinner. We humble ourselves before you. God, have mercy on us, the sinners.